Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Okay, he's gathered up some animals now, and the rains flood, or start us with where the rains come down or whatever, David.
What we're going to see then in terms of documentary analysis is that each story is going to deal with God and his relationship to Noah and humanity and the resolution to the flood in a different way. And so that's why I think it's important to begin as we did in terms of documentary analysis with identifying the fact that we have two different narratives that are brought together here.
Okay.
So going back to Jay then, and we'll draw upon that idea of the parent relationship or metaphor that I referred to at the beginning of the broadcast. In Jay, God is a father. He is a punitive father who fears his own children. He is afraid of being supplanted and abandoned by them. And he wishes to keep humans dependent and weak. He doesn't want them to become too divine or too much like the gods. Yahweh seems to fear that if the humans become strong, they will vie with him and possibly abandon him. But humans in the J narrative do become strong. And so God is forced to reject and eject them. And he therefore carries out his threat and brings about his own worst fear, if you will. Man is set on an independent course, and God has created the very situation that he tried to prevent. He, in a way, we could define him as a punitive superego, okay? Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Lamech, the sons of God, it's the same type of narrative over and over again, and he has to come to terms with the fact that humanity is evil and trying to constantly enter into a situation that he finds threatening. So we see this in chapter 6, verse 5. Yahweh saw how great was man's wickedness on earth and how every scheme that his mind devised was nothing but evil all the time. And for that reason, in Jay, God brings the flood. Yet after the flood, Yahweh realizes that he must treat the surviving human beings differently. And so therein he states at the end in chapter 8, verse 21, "Never again will I doom the world because of man, since the devising of man's mind are evil from the start." Notice the connection between these two texts. In other words, it's as if he's saying, I will never again bring a flood because man is evil by nature. But evil was the very reason that God gave prior to the flood to explain his decision to destroy humanity. And again, we have God acting in diametrically opposed ways. It's a paradox. God's utterance of contradictory statements in Jay, again, reflects the fact that we have a story that's being brought together that originally had two separate gods who held diametrically opposed perspectives and views on the flood and the salvation of humankind. But the destructiveness of the flood is brought home to Yahweh through this whole thing. He realizes how strong he is. That's number one. Therefore, he realizes that really he doesn't have to have that fear that he has that humans are going to become too much like him because he's really, really powerful. And number two, he realizes that he needs human beings. And that clearly appears in chapter 8, verses 20 through 21. And I'll read the text. Noah built an altar to Yahweh, and choosing from every clean animal and every clean bird, offered burnt offerings on the altar. That's why in Jay, Noah has to bring the clean animals because he has to offer the sacrifices and yet not eradicate his species.
Right.
And then we read that Yahweh smelled the soothing odor. He said to himself, "Never again will I doom the world because of man, since the devisings of man's heart are evil from the start." neither will I ever again strike down every living human being as I have done. And we see the same theme that we found in the Mesopotamian resolution to the flood story. The theme is food. You know, gods are starving to death. They're hungry, remember, in Atrahasis. And so they need humankind to provide sacrifices and feed them, which is the very thing that God has to realize in the J story. So ultimately, the resolution of the J story is, you know what? Human beings are evil. They're going to constantly try to do things that are going to organize and create a situation that threatens Yahweh. But Yahweh recognizes through the flood how truly powerful he is. But he also recognizes, just as the Mesopotamian deities did, that he has this need for humankind and enjoys being fed, if you will, through the sacrifice, the soothing odor, and the things that come right from Mesopotamia. So the metaphor for God's need for humanity is food. An image which, again, basically comes from the Mesopotamian material.
Great. Okay, what about the P writer?
So the priestly author comes after J and is really writing in a way to correct the J narrative, because he feels so uncomfortable with the idea of, not only theologically some of the things that are stated there concerning God and his nature, but also with the idea that Noah could present sacrifices, because sacrifice from P's perspective is an institution that begins with Aaron and the great high priest. So P is written in a way to correct that narrative, and then the editor is going to bring and harmonize these two things together.
Go for it.
Okay. So in P, remember, God is presented as separate from the world. He's not really going to physically interact with the world in the very anthropomorphic way that we see God doing in J. Yet P, if we recall, he created humans in his own image. Remember Genesis chapter 1, verse 27 that we discussed in the previous broadcast. He creates man in his own image, and he tells them to rule and reign over the earth. So verses 28 and 29 in P, God is going to bless humankind and say to them, be fertile and increase, fill the earth and subdue it. Subject the fishes of the sea, the birds of the sky, and all the living things that move on earth. And God further says, see, I give you, and this is the important part, I give you every seed-bearing plant on earth and every tree in which the seed-bearing fruit of the tree, they shall be yours for food. Okay? Mm-hmm. So humankind is created, according to P's narrative, to rule and have dominion on earth as the image of God. God is kind of the absentee parent, if you will. He creates humankind and he says, okay, go do your thing. But remember, humankind, they're still infants, if you will. And so they don't prove successful at doing the subduing and the ruling that God had assigned them to do in the priestly narrative. And the second point on that is that humankind, they're created specifically, according to P, to be herbivores or vegetarians. And the same kind of food in P is given to the animals in Genesis chapter 1, verse 30, to all the animals on land and all the birds of the sky and all the living creatures that crawl on earth. God states, I give all the green plants as their food.
Mm.
So the humans are in P to reproduce. But both they and the animals are specifically commanded not to eat meat, only plants. That is, they're not to eat other animals, and they're certainly not to eat each other. Okay, so ultimately, we have the same idea that is driving the narrative, in the sense of there's a reproduction issue and there's a food issue. Those are the two themes that happened in Atrahasis and also in J.
Hmm, that's fascinating. So how does P explain the fact that we ended up eating flesh and animals ate other animals?
Well, it happens because of overpopulation, right? Because overpopulation and there isn't enough food sources and people become more and more aggressive and humans become there are proof incapable of truly ruling and having the type of dominion that God himself would have.
Okay.
So in chapter 9, God resolves the problem in P in 9, 1 through 2. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fertile and increase and fill the earth. Dread fear of you shall possess all the animals of the earth, all the birds of the sky, everything which the ground is astir, and all the fishes of the sea, they are placed in your hand. And so just as in Genesis 1, humans are intended to reproduce in P here in Genesis chapter 9 and to have power over nature. But here's the key. The addition is in verse 3. Every creature that is alive shall be yours to eat. I give them all to you as I did with the grasses of the field. So, in other words, humans may now eat not only vegetation as before, but they may also eat animals. However, God has to establish a limitation on this. And so that's provided in verse 4. Only flesh with its lifeblood shall it be, shall you not eat. In other words, you're not supposed to consume blood because blood is sacred. Blood is holy. It belongs rightfully to God, which is why in P, Dan, it's so wonderful how this all works together. This is why in P that blood will be used as a ritual detergent to absorb impurity in the tabernacle and temple rituals.
Interesting.
So it all, I mean, we're starting to see that why documentary analysis is so important to understand not only the inconsistencies that appear in these various traditions, but also to see the way that it's just beautiful to see that the way that once we extract the narratives and put them together as a whole, as independent wholes, we're able to see how well these themes tie in with Aaron receiving the priesthood, beginning the sacrifices there, and the role of blood as a ritual detergent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Awesome. Brian, anything in Islam for the flood stuff that maybe we haven't, I'm sure we're going to go back and catch some more things, but we just haven't heard from you in a while. What's up in your brain?
Well, the Muslim sources focus mostly on Noah preaching and the people being rebellious and mocking him. At one point, when he's building the ark, they'll come up and say, "Oh, now you're a carpenter, huh? You were a prophet before, but now you're a carpenter. Okay, great." So it's just kind of focusing in on the, the persecution aspect, I guess.
Which would explain why this is the end of the epic. And yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So just the, okay, specifics there. Anything else in the, the actual floating of the ark and, coming to rest or in the timing of it or any of that?
Well, the Muslims have a couple stories about two people that survived the flood outside the ark.
Oh.
And if you're interested.
Do they play a key role in the tradition?
Well, they're in the tradition. I don't know if they're not really – they're more like just, I guess, anecdotes, I suppose.
Is a couple dudes in a rowboat or how they've survived?
Well, one was King Og, the son of Anak, and he was so tall that the water only came up to his knees. So he was okay. And he actually helped build the ark. He went out and got some of the timber for the ark. And so – so he was quite helpful. Another one is a story about an old woman. Let me just share the actual tradition with you, if you don't mind. During the construction of his ship, an old woman approached Noah and asked him, "Why are you building this?" He informed her of the major flood that was to come, but unlike the others, this woman didn't refute it, but instead replied, "Let me know when it's about to happen so I may also climb on board." She then retreated to her cottage, which stood separate from the rest of the city. Noah was understandably busy leading up to the event, and when the punishment of Allah finally arrived, he could only watch as the entire earth was overtaken with water, a flood that engulfed every disbeliever that previously didn't believe in it. When the water later receded, Noah exited the ship to stand on land once more. He was surprised to see the same lady approach him once again and ask, "So when's the flood going to come?" Noah replied, "Lady, the flood is over. How could you have survived it?" The woman then said, "I must be fortunate then that the one, capital O, who saved your ship also chose to save me." And the lesson is, this is a little lesson that they put on this little story, whoever surrenders to Allah will never be deserted by him.
Nice. Yeah, and Islam means submission or surrender, so that's a nice little...
Exactly.
Yeah, very
so they
cool.
take a little bit more pedagogical approach there, I guess.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, good. So, David, what else is fascinating in the text for you?
Well, I just... Going back then to the idea of P and what the problem was in the flood, the problem in P is not the same problem that we saw in Jay, in the sense that humans are, you know, usurping their some of Yahweh's divinity. But instead, the problem seems to be identified in chapter 6, verses 11 and 13. So I'm in chapter 6, verse 11. We read that the earth became corrupt before God, which, by the way, is a priestly concern, right? The idea that we can actually corrupt the earth and so forth, and that through wickedness. It became corrupt. The earth was filled with lawlessness, is the way the Jewish Publication Society translation renders the term. The actual word, and this will interest, of course, Brian, is chamatz, full of violence.
And that's what King James has, violence.
Yes,
violence.
Yeah,
yes.
And that happens in chapter 11 and verse 13. And so what's fascinating is remember that God, in P, creates human beings to reflect his image, to rule and to have dominion upon the earth, and to reproduce. Remember, reproduce. So it's just the exact opposite of J, where God doesn't, in essence, give them the sexual knowledge that they need in order to reproduce. In P, again, reacting to this theme and not really accepting it, P is going to take it a different direction and say reproduce, but instead of filling the earth with population, in chapter 6, verses 11 and 13, they fill the earth with chamatz, violence. Humans have filled the earth with that lawlessness because they are fighting against each other, they're killing animals, they're doing all these sorts of things that are problematic. And God is just surprised with how incredibly violent that humankind has become and how unable they are to be like him, which is something that in P, he wants them to be from the beginning. He creates them in their image. So we're seeing two very different views upon God and his relationship to humankind that I think a Latter-day Saint audience, in understanding historical criticism, the way biblical scholars would read this, would be able to find things that interest them, but also that they can relate to in both views, and also that, you know, that will be a little bit different.
Hmm. Cool. Anything else in fascination to you? Otherwise, I want to move to the end of the flood and the covenanting and all that stuff.
I'm ready to move on, then, if you guys are, to that part. I feel like I've, you know, provided, hopefully, the audience with a basic idea as to, you know, a jumping off point as to where they can take their studies and see how scholars understand these two different narratives and how they are brought together and how they are different as well.
So. Okay. Well, I do want to do the covenant, and let me tell you my goals for the rest of the thing. I want to get to the covenant business. I want to talk about how to work in these insights into LDS, you know, Sunday discourse, you know, how do we take advantage of these insights? Which ones would we want to back away from? You know, what's too big a hurdle and things like that to do it. And then the third one is to kind of talk about what the scholarly consensus is today about, you know, local flood versus a universal flood, how scholars are starting to see the value of biblical narratives, even though they don't take them literally and things like that. And so it's just sort of a general wider framing. So those are the three things I want to continue to do. So basically, the waters have receded, the dove has come back with the olive branch, Noah now knows that the earth is being cleared, you know, it's the water's draining away. Tell us about the covenant.
In a sense, I feel like we've already hinted at that and directed it in terms of the resolution of the flood story, looking at it from the Yahweh's perspective and from the priestly perspective. Ultimately, in J, Yahweh has to come to terms. He has to evolve. He has to realize that his nature and his relationship to his humans has to evolve. He has to come to terms with the fact that they are evil, that they're doing things that he disapproves of, and yet he doesn't need to be threatened by them because he has this immense power as demonstrated through the flood, and he sees a benefit to having them around in terms of their ability to feed him through sacrifice, which are the themes that we saw that the Yahwist is drawing upon from the Mesopotamian stories. And P doesn't like those ideas, and so, you know, the priestly author is going to take it in an entirely different direction. Still, we see the issues of overpopulation that we saw in Mesopotamian tradition. We see the idea of God having to come to terms with the fact that his creations aren't exactly what he would like them to be, which in B is that he wants them to be like he is holy, right? Holy like he is holy. And so he has to come to terms with that. And so he has to evolve as well. But ultimately in that resolution, it is that God's going to allow human beings now to start to consume meat and not just vegetation. And just with the stipulation, they should never, ever partake of blood because blood is holy and is going to be used in the rituals of the priestly author. So as I see it, those are the two different resolutions to the flood narrative.
Okay. Well, let's talk a minute about the token of the covenant, the rainbow and all that. Because again, you know, we're a lot of this, we're dealing in the realm of people who don't understand mythic nature of things. They don't understand kind of what we're talking about here. Ancient worldviews in which this kind of stuff made perfect sense because if you start with XYZ premises, you know, all this stuff works. You know, there's so many people today that says, well, it couldn't be a universal flood because obviously there's not enough water, you know, to ever do something like that. There's no archaeological record and things like that. So they just dismiss all this. So I kind of want to, you know, in our next, you know, the last minutes of our discussion here, I want to kind of work on those types of issues. So one of the things is the rainbow. The idea they look at, they say, oh, they're trying to pretend that there was no such thing as a rainbow prior to the flood. You know, like all of a sudden water and the prismatic action that causes a rainbow of light going through the water droplets, all of a sudden that starts, ha, ha, ha. So what do you think is happening there? Do you think that's what the authors are claiming, that would be the meaning of rainbow? Or is it just like a handy thing that God would now say, this will be my token of the covenant?
Well, I actually do believe that these stories are dealing with etiology and the origins of human institutions and natural phenomena as well. And it is a different worldview. We see that, for example, in Genesis chapter 7, verse 11. I'll quote the King James, the same day, speaking of the flood, were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. If our listeners will recall, we discussed that idea of the firmament that God created in Genesis chapter 1 as a plastic type dome that separated the waters above from the waters below. And so what happens is that God opens up the window of heaven, the same window he'll open to pour out a blessing in Malachi. And the waters that are up above in the universe come down and flood the earth, as does the water from the great deep. And in that sense, we have ultimately the earth is taken back to its primordial, unorganized, chaotic condition that is referred to in both in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, in terms of and in Jay's account of that, both of which are somewhat of an aside, describing the chaotic situation that the earth was found in prior to creation. We have water, we have earth, all these things, but they're totally unorganized. So what God is doing is he is taking back the earth and taking it back to chaos and, you know, starting over, if you will, in a sense. And that's how they're going to explain ultimately the rise of human institutions and ultimately the way that the world exists in its current present order through this flood story, just as the Mesopotamians did as well. And as we see in Genesis chapter 7, verse 11, whether we're talking about the waters of the great deep, the firmament, or as you mentioned, the origin of the rainbow, this is a way of conceptualizing the world that is pre-scientific, if you will.
Right, that's what I was about to say, pre-scientific, but logical within its own
definitely
worldview.
And beautiful.
Yeah, that whole pillars of the earth, the firmament, the waters below, and all that stuff, you know, this all makes perfect sense within that as your cosmology.
Exactly.
It's also interesting that some in the rainbow believe they see some eschatology, at least from a typological point of view, like the last color of the rainbow in Daniel chapter 7, you know, where it deals with the ancient did set and so on the throne, the last color of the rainbow would be the kingdom of God in literary structure.
Okay, and is the last color?
White colors correspond to levels of rain from the gods above.
Interesting. Is the final color purple or something? Is that why it's the kingly thing or something?
Precisely. There's just some liturgical, priestly, and some significance eschatologically that's later put to this particular covenant, you know, of the rainbow.
Okay, cool.
And isn't that what Joseph Smith did with it too? Made it more eschatological.
Oh, remind me, where in the text is that, Brian?
Well, I think it's in the teachings book where he talks about the rainbow. Of course, I'm drawing from, you know, I think I might know type thing.
Okay, memory from
for sure.
From reading it years and years ago. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I can't recall that. Does any Tom? Well, Tom, you know a lot of Mormon stuff, or David, do you recall what Brian's talking about there?
Yes, Joseph Smith does talk about the rainbow as a sign. Remember, I think in terms of the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, what Brian's referring to is the sign that God will, the year that the bow is not seen, that is the year that Christ will return. Remember, is that prophecy. But we also see something I think Brian's hinting to that's really great is in the JST, the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis chapter 9 takes the bow in a fascinating way. And that, and our LDS audience can find that in the, you know, the footnotes too lengthy to be added at the bottom of the page in the JST section after the Bible dictionary.
Oh.
We have Genesis chapter 9, 21 through 25, JST. And it's talking about Enoch and Zion. And we read, "The bow shall be in the cloud," and this is God's promising to Noah, "I will look upon it that I may remember the everlasting covenant which I made unto thy father Enoch, that when men should keep all my commandments, Zion should again come on the earth, the city of Enoch which I caught up unto myself. And this is mine everlasting covenant, that when thy posterity shall embrace the truth and look upward, then shall Zion look downward, and all the heavens shall shake with gladness, and the earth shall tremble with joy. And the general assembly of the church of the firstborn shall come down out of heaven and possess the earth, and shall have place until the end come. And this is mine everlasting covenant, which I made with thy father Enoch. And the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will establish my covenant unto thee," and then it goes on and talks about Noah. So the rainbow is in JST is the way I'm seeing it. It becomes a type of link between heaven and earth, right? So just as the bow stretches from a cloud and in heaven and comes down and touches the earth, we have two different spheres that will be linked in the second coming of Christ. You have the assembly of the church of the firstborn, you have the city of Enoch, which is taken up into heaven, and it will come down and be linked so that Zion is connected as the rainbow connects heaven and earth, and it will connect these two spheres and bring them together.
Very interesting. That might be good Sunday school stuff to play with.
Sure, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Now, on the other hand, how do we take the... Clearly, Joseph Smith in this case isn't reading these as mythical texts. He's probably talking literally here. So we have just that general problem that we'll often have with, especially I think, well, I mean, pretty much all the scriptural texts or something, but mostly I think in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, it's really magnified of how can I have my brain and my awareness of physics and these laws and still find value in all of this. So there's a nice theological picture of the joining in the heaven and the earth and all that stuff in the mythic realm, but one would get a sense that Joseph Smith thought he was really restoring something that literally is going to happen. So, Brian, I've had David talk about this before, and I want him to talk about it again, but how do you, like, make those... How do you make a bridge between the people that just say, I just can't go there, I can't even entertain this kind of literal view? If I'm forced to do that, I've just got to be forced out of Mormonism.
Well, I'm not really sure how to respond to that.
That's a tough question.
It is. Maybe we should ask a third party like Tom.
Well, he really helped us in that last one. And Tom, you can do it again, because you say when traditions try to push the whole mythic thing, their congregations, revolt, right?
Exactly. There's an excellent book I'd recommend. It's called Reading Scripture as Myth, that I think has marvelous things to offer in this balancing act that we all struggle with. Now, in my conservative training and my master's degree on the lower divisions, they changed the meaning of literal. And I do not know if many people are aware of this, but it used to be, you know, that street would mean, you know, the literal streets going through Jerusalem, and Greek terms like chabas for road, you know, you really didn't put as much of a layered effect on them to mean the way or something like that, you know, to Zion or the way to describe Christianity. Now there's been a pushback towards the conservative scholars who are now saying this. Now, boy, what an echo of rethinking this is. Now they say literal means, well, what the author intended. Wow, what a shift. Even R.C. Sproul and others are saying that the conservative movement has been too wooden in its approach, you know, to biblical studies. So, well, okay, but if we understand what the J writer, the P writer, or the D writer meant, well, then, of course, we're opening up for all kinds of possibilities, aren't we? And therefore, let's deal with oftentimes what church people mean and members of denominations is not always a literal approach, but it's more of a wooden approach, as R.C. Sproul has said. You know, it's more the idea there's one meaning to this text. I've got it because it affirms my faith, and there is nothing else. Well, we know even in the Hebrew, there's 10 words for blessing. There's 6 meanings for a word day. You know, so we know even linguistically that just doesn't work.
Okay,
so now let's bring this to the theology of the faithful. I think once people in the Methodist, the Anglican, and some of the more liberal Presbyterian USA churches and others begin to see that there is a different way of reading Scripture, what happened was the congregations were not prepared. All of a sudden, Bultmann, von Rad, and mythical interpretations were just shoved over the pulpit. And all of a sudden, we were asking our congregations to move from a letteristic approach, you know, that there's just kind of one obvious meaning, and that's what it meant, and that's what the commentary said, that's what my Sunday school teacher said, I believe it. All of a sudden, to everything was up in the air. You couldn't be sure of anything. Well, how did that, you know, go with, it's like saying to people, let's all come to the Kiwanis Club. Now, we're not sure why we're here. We're not sure if we can trust our creed. We're not sure if we can trust our mission and our goals and what we want to accomplish here. So what this did is it caused an erosion of faith because there was not a good hermeneutic to put in its place to understand Scripture either on a higher level, a narrative level, a thematic level, or anything other than you can't trust it, you know?
So how do you teach it, Tom, when you teach it, knowing that this whole problem is, how do you just go ahead and go with where the people are, or how do you open the windows a bit?
Well, basically, what I try to do is show how the thematic levels through Scripture change and are developed and maintained and as they grow with the revelation. That seems to open people up without threatening them too much. And see, what we want to be careful of is if we pull the props out from under our faith communities, know what to put back. Because people are not going to take the time to read Stibbs, to read Wiseman, you know, to read Vesserman, to understand what Bultmann means when he talks about, you know, the Sitzenleben, you know, the real life story situation. They are simply not going to process this material. So it needs to be encoded for them as to have spiritual, theological, and eschatological value, or they simply won't know how to frame it.
Okay, so let's now look at the flood story. What is the theological value, the eschatological value? What is it that's positive that makes you feel good as somebody who's aware of all this, and yet you on a Sunday could teach that? And I want Brian and David to kind of answer this too. So start with you, Tom.
Well, basically, it's theological value. How no matter how far man strays from God, Yahweh knows how to bring us back to paradise or paradiso. Okay. That's number one. Number two, that God grows. Number three, that no matter what happens, new creation can be reestablished, a new order, a new society.
Nice.
See, and people will find life in that God still is in control, although we might look at it as open theism, as I do. You know, that God will step in and see mankind sway back and forth, and God will step in and make it ultimately come out his way without controlling all of the events in between. Then when we go to Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 3, of course, well, the flood is tied to the beginning of a nation. It's tied to a covenant. It's even tied to a baptism, something that our Pentecostal brothers and sisters like to, you know, pick up on that. And so I think it also is reinterpreted in Isaiah and the book of Revelation to refer to a flood of people. And that come out of the sea and, of course, you know, worship the beast. And then, you know, God has to step in and, of course, restore correct worship. So there's all kinds of thematic themes that come from this. Now, when you're in a fundamentalist type of school that I started out in, I didn't end up in one, but I started out where books like this were used in my master's study, the Biblical Flood and the Ice Epoch. Now, what they're trying to show is how there could have been a worldwide flood, or was it local, and all this sort of thing. The fact that it could have been, you know, worldwide is ridiculous. You mean there was water going up 29,000 feet, you know, over Mount Everest? There's not enough water. Then they try to argue catastrophism. The Creation Research Institute with Dr. Gish and others, I've listened to hours and hours and hours of this explanation, how to read Genesis scientifically, and when you look at the data, then the big fight is over C-12 to C-14, and how far back do these issues really go? It, you know, was there really a flood in 2369 B.C. And all of this? But one of the things they won't touch, by 1924, there was a scholarly book out called Myths and Legends All Over the World. Well, I really believe wholeheartedly that it's the myth and the legend that is being picked up here. And what it's trying to tell us is God always saves human beings, no matter how rough it gets. If he chooses eight, God is going to prevail and bring peace and order and redemption to this world, no matter what men does.
Very cool. And some of that anticipated where we'll go at the end when we talk about, you know, the today's science and their interaction with it. But thank you. So, Brian or David, when you teach LDS folks about the flood, what are your takeaways that are positive, even as you don't overcomplicate it with all the, you know, mythic layers?
Well, I'll jump in and I'll state that it depends on which LDS audience that I'm teaching, right? I mean, Sunday school would be different than a seminary class. A seminary class would be different than an institute class. You know, so it really depends. I don't, but as a basic model, I love the way that Tom frames this in terms of theological constructs. When we read the Old Testament carefully and critically, the portrayal of God theologically can be that of a frightening being. Or, I mean, on the one hand, he's incredibly powerful. But on the other hand, especially in Jay, he's highly emotional, right? And so these are fascinating theological constructs. And if I'll open up myself and just speak personally, I guess, on the matter. And if, as a Latter-day Saint, this is why I love the work that we refer to as the Restoration, that comes through the prophet Joseph Smith. And as I understand the Restoration, Dan, it's not so much a complete restoring of truths that were once known in antiquity, though that certainly does happen, but it's really a recasting and a reformulation, again, drawing that example of ex nihilo creation. And so a Matthew Day, it's Joseph Smith is imitating God's creative work in bringing structure and to chaos, ultimately, different theological views, some of which we would reject as a Latter-day Saint. That's why I, speaking personally, I love the Book of Moses. And I deal, not to do a shameless plug, but I deal with this issue in my forthcoming book for Kofert, hopefully out by the end of the year. And that is what I see happening in terms of the JST, the Book of Moses, is that it's taking the Bible and it's giving order to these various different theological constructs in a way that can make sense for an LDS audience. And it takes the prehistory in Genesis and ultimately transforms that into revelatory material, into a revelation that Moses receives on an exceedingly high mountain. Therefore, it takes the opening chapters of Genesis and makes it temple literature. And it allows Latter-day Saints to go into the narrative and view themselves, the biblical narrative, and view themselves as Adam, as Eve, as Noah, and use these stories to define their own personal relationship to God. And so I from that end, even though, for example, a book like the Book of Moses, from my perspective, in light of higher criticism, cannot be said to be literally recreating something that Moses wrote, it has great spiritual and scriptural worth as something that is providing order to the chaos.
And you're able to say that in most audiences because that what you just said includes the idea that this couldn't have been written by Moses.
Well, it depends on the audience. And, you know, I wouldn't throw this out to a seminary class or something along those lines. Okay. No, I wouldn't necessarily, but it, you know, depends on which group that we're talking to. And you know, I'd take it from that angle.
Okay, good. Feel free to jump in again. Brian, is there anything that when you've taught the flood that you seem to focus on that you feel good about?
You know, if you just look at the footnotes with, let's say, chapter 6:2, where it's talking about interfaith marriage, these kinds of things, and the brethren have, you know, I'm at BYU, religious education, as you know, and so when we focus on scripture, it's didactic. It's you know, what can you apply to your own life, this kind of a thing. Now, that's not to say that we can't talk a little bit about scholarly theories and those kinds of things, as David has, you know, so eloquently done throughout this whole broadcast here. You know, you can talk about those things, but somewhere along the line, you've got to talk about, okay, what does this mean for us? What does this mean for you and your life? Okay, God has limits. God doesn't like interfaith marriage. God, you know, these kinds of things. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, that's exactly what I teach. when I talk about interfaith marriage, I talk about it differently than maybe some others might do that, because I come from a family that there's nobody LDS in the family, and so I come from a non-LDS background as a Catholic.
Right.
So
so
I kind of have some different views on some of this kind of thing, but I still try to in the classroom anyway. I'll still try to help the students understand, you know, the importance of a temple marriage, that kind of a thing. And so I kind of focus in on some of those kinds of things. But now that I've heard David, I may actually reorient my thinking a little bit on this. I love this whole idea of these different strands of, you know, like the J and the P and what they're trying to do. I thought that was very enlightening, David. So,
oh, good. Yeah, I don't believe it has to be an either or.
Right.
No, I mean we have to. I mean, you're not going to throw out, to like I said, to a group of seminary students all of the intricacies of the documentary hypothesis. In fact, even though Dan referred to the fact that I have taught for CES for many years, I've never done that, not even at an institute level. But some elements of it can be brought into a religious devotional context and used to then go in the direction that Brian's talking about in terms of spiritual application. I definitely am with you, Brian.
Okay. Let me just say back here, so Tom, I think, hit this the best in terms of, here's a flood, it sucks. There's very few people that I know that like the flood story, you know, that God would wipe everybody out. You know, it helps to have the whole sense of the J writer and what, you know, this emotional God and feel and threatened and all that stuff. But nobody likes it. But Tom says, you know, even out of this, God will save humanity. Somehow or other, it'll work towards God's purposes and stuff. So that's a positive thing about the flood. Brian and David, I didn't really hear anything from either of you about, would you go there? Or, I mean, do you agree with Tom that those are places to go? In other words, you know, why are we spending a week in Sunday school on the flood takeaway, that this is still a good and loving God type thing? Do either of you guys?
I do. I love the way that Tom explained that, and I think it would be a great way to take it for an LDS devotional context. I would also bring in the insights from the JST in terms of the Book of Moses and talk about Terrell and Fiona Givens' book, The God Who Weeps. You know, they talk about how God is so emotional. He's powerful, yet he is emotional. And it's and take it perhaps theologically in the sense that his emotion is tied into what we see as his great desire to bring to pass our immortality and our eternal life. And in as much as things get in the way of that, God is going to be powerful and to take a stance to help eradicate the problem and help create a situation that will bring to pass his children's development and growth in advance spiritually. And we definitely get that in terms of Joseph Smith's recasting of it in terms of the Book of Moses. And as much as I love the Givens book, and I do, and I sing its praises, it's one of my favorite books, ultimately we're still left with the fact, even in the Book of Moses, that God does decide to eradicate
humanity. Start over.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, but again, we could tie it into just how passionate he is about his work in glory, which is to help us grow and to develop and to become like him.
And it's interesting also with Moses 7, where you get the personification of the, you know, the earth personifying some sort of a statement there, groaning. That element in there is really unique, and that's a preceding the flood, if I understand. You know, how long shall I bear this wickedness that's upon me, the pollutions, these kinds of things. And so it brings in just another very interesting element there that I talk about anyway with LDS audiences.
Okay, well, that's a good transition to something I definitely wanted to deal with, because as we move into, is it a universal flood versus a limited flood, there's that theological piece that it always comes up in Mormonism, and I'm guessing it comes up in wider Christian, especially, you know, more traditional Christian modes, is this idea of the earth needing to be baptized. And that's why, you know, it's a hesitation for somebody to say, oh, it's a limited flood. No, because it needed to be completely baptized, just like we need to be completely baptized and stuff. How do you guys, you know, structure a conversation about that?
I think the baptismal motif that we draw and emphasize in an LDS context is absolutely wonderful. We're dealing with theological constructs, and that can be seen in terms of the flooding of the earth as a symbol, or taking away the iniquity. We talked about that in Cain's sacrifice in the previous broadcast. It eradicates the curse that God places upon the earth because of the sin that is that Adam and Eve, engage in the garden context. So I think it works really well as a baptismal motif. Obviously, as one who believes in historical criticism and the origins of these traditions in terms of Mesopotamian mythology, I don't take it and mix in a scientific view of it and try to argue
it had to be the entire globe.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I can't see it that way. But as a symbol, as a theological construct, for me, that works very well. Okay.
You don't hate it, but yeah, you just don't.
I love it.
Yeah, good, good. Now, I think you have to go. Is that what I'm hearing?
I hate to be abrupt in my termination for this conversation, but I've so enjoyed being able to contribute to hear Tom's and Brian's thoughts. And Dan, you're a great commentator and director in this, but I do have to run for some activities.
It's great to have you with us, David.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And I'll let you guys
thank
continue.
You, David. Always insightful.
Yeah, thank you both. I look forward to listening to the broadcast.
We'll catch you on and you'll catch you when we go to the next subjects that we'll do. So
we'll
come back in about 6 weeks or something.
Okay.
So thanks.
Thank you
Take
so
care.
Much. Bye.
Bye, David. Take care.
Bye.
Okay, Brian, how about you when you think of the baptism thing? Again, I like what David said. I think you can get a lot with it. Yeah, as a motif, this is great. How do you, like in a Sunday school class, say, you know, this doesn't necessarily mean the entire planet covered with water?
Well, I'm with David on this as far as it being a theological construct. You know, that certainly the idea of the earth being baptized with water is an important belief, I guess, an important way to kind of describe, you know, the progress that we have in terms of ordinances and those kinds of things. And we take that a little bit further, as you know, where we believe that the earth itself is going through a similar process that we go through in terms of baptism, confirmation, you know, with the earth being burned, this kind of thing,
right,
and the earth eventually being resurrected. And so it's part of a continuum to say that it's that the earth gets baptized, because that's a necessary thing, just like it is for people to be baptized. And so I'm totally fine with that. As far as the science of it, I'm probably with David again on this. But let me go on to another part, because Dan, you had asked me to kind of deal with the local versus universal within Islam.
Yes,
correct?
Please. Sure.
Is this a okay time to do
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah. I definitely don't want to quite finish. I want to let me do this then first. So you're saying again theologically you don't mind it and stuff, but then you're about to talk the science, and I know that's where you had Dwayne Jeffrey wrote an article for Sunstone that I published when I was the editor, and one of his quotes in here, he says, "Many Latter-day Saints and students of our theology make us out to be animists who believe the earth to be a living thing." So animism, you know, animists,
right.
To living thing, and therefore in need of baptism. By this logic, then every living thing needs to be baptized. I'm not sure we'd want to take that on. So just in his little, you know, calm way, Dwayne goes, are you sure you really want to go down this road? And then he talks about some reasons to not think that it needed to be a universal, you know, full earth flood, and why aren't we baptizing animals, you know, and all that stuff today. And so
exactly.
he kind of plays it with it there theologically. I wanted to make sure we got that. But yeah, go ahead and talk, please, in Islam about the universal versus local, and then we can talk in general. But also, Tom, I want you to talk in when the time comes about, is there this idea of the baptismal stuff for the earth playing in other traditions too? So, but go ahead, Brian, please, on Islam.
Okay, it won't be very long. So in Islam, most we'll call them Muslim apologists, defend the idea that the flood was local and that it was only those within earshot of Noah. So if you didn't hear Noah, then you're not part of it.
Interesting.
But you've got people out there that will use the Quran and lots of these traditions that I've kind of talked about throughout this podcast that suggest or not suggest they strongly say that the earth was totally immersed in water. completely. And so they get after the Muslim apologists for defending the indefensible, what they say. And so it's there's a kind of a battle going on there. And of course, the ones that are really pushing the local are, you know, they're maybe a little bit more on the science side of things, because science seems to fit better with the local flood than it does with the universal one. And so I just wanted you just to say that there is a, I guess, a somewhat of a debate going on there in terms of local versus universal flood.
Even there, just the way there is in Judeo-Christianity. Yeah,
exactly.
Awesome. Good to know. Tom, how wide is this whole idea that the earth needed to be baptized?
Oh, it's in every ancient culture and spiritual tradition, clear from the Hopis to the Orient. A great book on this is by Lloyd R. Bailey, and it's called Noah, The Person and the Story in History and Tradition. If you want to read about that, I can't think of any book that's finer in that regard, because there is an old Mount Ararat tradition. There are traditions in Iraq. There are traditions, in the Caucasus Mountains about such an old story happening that the conservative archaeologists and commentators really play on that, and they tend to play down the idea that there were worldwide studies, and if they do mention them, then they say, well, the Genesis one is the real story. It's the the real capping of the ancient tradition, because we have Yahweh from the mountain, dictating all of this verbally. So we may have influences, from earlier times, in the cuneiform or in the writings of Sumer, but they try to show the superiority of the biblical model and how it plays into salvation history. So it tends to be the argument that they raise. But in all fairness, there is very old traditions on Mount Ararat in many languages that go back to this particular story.
Okay, but theoretically, does it need baptism just as it's going to need to be cleansed by fire? Is that widespread?
Here is where the Old Testament takes it. That is quite fascinating. When we look at the term curse reversal, what we see is a reversal of history as we move back towards Eden in salvation history. Then what we see, the curse of Canaan removed, we see death removed, we see the flood narrative and destruction removed, and there's a fire that comes, that God will baptize the earth with fire, and see, this is happening. All these curses are being reversed and a new history written as the new Passover happens. You see, as the flood becomes people, and the baptism becomes fire, and then all of a sudden, the earth is made righteous, and there's a wedding between Yahweh and his sons and daughters at Mount Zion, Revelation 14. So all of these curses that have been brought on through the first 11 chapters of Genesis are reversed, and Isaiah, in his Befeed Structures, does a beautiful job of showing us a new flood narrative, where the earth will be cleansed, where there'll be a new temple, a new land, and see, as the newness of these things are recreated, then the old covenant curse vanishes away. And then the chaos is brought back to order.
Yeah, interesting. Well, again, it just adds that, you know, the Bible is somewhat trying to present history, but clearly it's the writers who have a framing on this is what it means, this is the arc, this is the general purposes of God, and, so they're going to be structuring the stories to make it fit that, and that's the something that we all do in our lives, isn't it? That's just our nature is, what does this mean, where am I going, and we'll emphasize parts of our life that pick up on that theme better than other parts, right?
Well, and as we become more familiar with the biblical text, then we can take it within its time period. Like, what is Isaiah talking about? About the rebuilding of a temple, which is like a rebuilding of creation, a rebuilding of the priesthood. See, because all of this has been cursed and needs curse reversal to restore covenant, which you know, writes a new history and a new story in the new Adam.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Well, Brian, I think you're up on this stuff too. There is the Mesopotamian hypothesis of a local flood, and I've listened to a great podcast in the Krista Tippett on being, I think it was in August, and it's a fellow by the name of David Montgomery, who's a geologist, but he looks at long-term epics and things like this, and he's been looking at the interplay between religious texts and the actual land structures and whatnot, and he talks a lot about how the Mesopotamian region, that between the Tigris and the Euphrates, is a lot like New Orleans. And we all are very, very familiar now with how New Orleans so easily can be flooded. And so the idea of a local flood in that area that drives out all the people, and, you know, there's different showings of exoduses of people and whatnot from that region as it flooded, as possibly, you know, something that really happened. And then Ryan and Pittman are two scholars who I think in the early 1990s started to look at the Black Sea area, which is in Turkey, as probably the place for it. And that's Dwayne Jeffrey, the article that I quoted from in Sunstone. He's introducing that to people there as, again, this would be catastrophic. And when you only have the view of local people on the ground, and this much of everything of your known world gets wiped out, you would use this catastrophic language. You would use this universalizing language, and we don't necessarily have to fault them for that. And one of the neat things about what this David Montgomery says, he says, you know, I'm glad for these narratives because they've caused him to look at certain things, like he was in Tibet or up at least in the Himalayas and stuff like that, and there was this ancient story of a flood in that region, and he's going, what the heck? You know, there's no way that this region could have been flooded. And then, you know, he starts to map it out and to really see that there could have been this glacier that blocked up something, and when it receded, of course it would flood or things. And he basically was able to see that, and he tells the story of some guy who is now one of the more honored geologists and the, you know, the people that look at epochs of time right now, but he, for 30 years, he was seen as a fool because he thought Eastern Washington and kind of into Montana and Idaho and Montana and stuff was once completely underwater, and everyone's going, no way. But then finally, when the science evolves and you get to look at the perspectives from aerial types of mapping and things, they're able to see through glaciation and the receding of glaciers how these things might be. And so, anyway, this Montgomery was basically saying, and I thought it was a good thing, and I'll link certainly to it for our listeners, you know, honor the people who wrote their stories from their perspectives and things like that. These were probably based upon something, and then, you know, we've built on it, they've built on it into these larger things than they really were, but they're not, we shouldn't be dismissing these ancient tales of floods and things like that as, you know, completely misleading.
Well, it goes back to your question about myth. You know, myth is based on some sort of reality. It all is.
And so, right, and whether it's a physical action or just a psychological reality.
Exactly. And so, you know, myth isn't necessarily have to be a bad thing there.
Right. And that's completely where I, you know, my training in religious studies and things like that totally made me at home with this. And so when I was asking those questions about, you know, I'm going to feel forced out of religion if I have to, you know, entertain this. And, you know, even on Sunday to have to sit myself through this one where everybody's doing it literally, I'm going, you know, I don't feel forced out of Mormonism from it. I don't enjoy, you know, the ultra literal thing, but I can find my ways in to do the broader themes like Tom was sharing and what you guys were sharing.
Well,
too.
And I have no problem with that, even in class, talking about myth a little bit and what myth is. And so it shouldn't be a scary thing, I don't think.
Even conservative scholars such as John Warwick Montgomery, and there's nobody more conservative than he is, will admit that myth is just divine action within the human story.
Exactly. I love that.
Or the human take on the divine action.
Yeah.
Well, if you want a lower form of inspiration, most definitely.
You know, we need to explain why things are the way we are, and so we work on it, and I'm fine with being wrong. I'm sure we're going to be wrong massively within a few hundred years of what we're thinking these days. So I don't have any problem with it. And within the stories, these are brilliant people. They're insightful people. The writers of these things have, like David was talking about in Genesis 1 through 4, you know, whoever redacted that, he knew that those two stories conflicted with each other. And we could have asked him about that, you know, having the J and the P woven in this flood stuff. Those guys aren't dumb. They did this for a purpose, and they're not afraid of that, of it kind of having a both and.
Well, Brother Dan, they didn't have the same chronological sense of history that we do, you know, in the modern world. There's a great article on this in the Jerome Biblical Commentary where they show how ancient people told history, you know, with myths and legends and soothsayers and oral traditions all mixed in to form the new package. So, you know, along we come with our German rational mind, right, and say, well, this doesn't make sense. If they'd come back from the dead, they'd tell us, well, it doesn't have to.
Interesting. That's fun. Yeah, and, you know, we even have this going on with Jesus. You know, we've got the Matthew writer that wants to do everything he can to make Jesus's, you know, early life match with Moses, you know, and the killing of the infants and all that different stuff. And then Luke comes along and he's using Samuel as the example, you know, and again, they're basically saying, this is what this person means. This is what this person is all about. This is how important it is. And I'm just trying to convey that. So there's no sense in their minds that they're lying to you or anything like that. They're just really trying to give you, you know, here's the final thing is this guy's a pivotal figure, you know, and so I'm going to structure my story that way because I'm absolutely certain that that's the truth, that that person, Jesus in this case, is that important, you know. So it is, it's just a different sense of history and what the purposes of writing these things are, you know. Plutarch's Lives, you know, I've read around in that 900 to 1200 page book and things like that, you know. It's basically, let's just structure everybody's life in terms of kind of these patterns and whatnot that you just but again, you're not lying. Anything else, you guys? I think we've kind of hit things. I'll certainly provide some links, but what's left on either of your notepads coming into the podcast that you weren't able to share today? Tom?
Well, just basically that Reinhard Niebuhr, in his book, The Nature and Destiny of Man, I think the flood narrative has a lot to tell us about human nature. About that we have a tendency to wind things down, even though God is trying to lift us Godward, you know. God is trying to, you know, lead us, you know, to the great theosis where man will share the divine essence of God. And yet there is this struggle for uncreation where God has to kind of leave us to our our own devices and then step in as he needs to, as Niebuhr suggests, to bring us, you know, back to him. And that he doesn't deal with everything between A and Z. He'll allow us to zig and zag and just, you know, tighten down the screws when he needs to get his ultimate will done. And I think the flood is a beautiful illustration of this in salvation history. And as far as the great, you know, kenosis, you know, God's becoming men, God is a great deal more like us and part of us as we share in his divine essence. Genesis 5:3, I think, echoes this. And I'm so sad when I think the Christian church looks at man as a cursed being, you know, due to a misunderstanding of the fall and a misunderstanding of the corrupt nature that they believe, thanks to Saint Augustine, who gave us the original sin doctrine, something that is foreign to the biblical writer. It's foreign to the Eastern Church, and it's foreign to Mormonism, praise God, you know, as well. And what I think it has done to people when they hear this type of condemnation is that creation by God was allowed to become corrupt, and somehow God didn't like it. He's angry with man, you know, that he has let man become so decrepit, as Augustine said, you know that even sex itself has become something that God was ashamed of. Later, Thomas Aquinas added, and I think what has happened in the general person's mind when they hear this nonsense preached in church, they say, well, I know I've got my problems. I'm a weak human being. But yet, isn't there good in human beings too? Well, creation says there was. It was tov ma'ov. Look around, and it was very good. Man was. The trees were. You know, everything was. And it's part of God's goodness that allows us to make our mistakes. It's part of God's goodness to woo us home again. Nice. You know, to the new Eden. I see that as the real Christian message that we share with the LDS Church. I see that is the idea that God will still share his divinity with us in spite of all of this.
So great. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for being with us again, and we'll have you for the next one as well soon. Brian, what else is left?
I really appreciate Father Tom and his thoughts there. A true theologian, definitely.
Yes, absolutely.
I guess what I've really enjoyed in this podcast is learning a little bit more about not just intertext. I mean, it looks like the Bible itself has connections to other texts, such as David was saying with Enlil and Enki and Gilgamesh and all these other ancient Near Eastern texts. But it also has an intratext, and I hadn't really considered that as much, and that's, of course, the documentary hypothesis with the J and the P kind of interacting there and having and bringing together, you know, the story in different ways, and I just thought I found that fascinating. The other thing is that as Latter-day Saints, I don't think we should necessarily be afraid of that. Afraid of what good scholarship has helped us to understand, because perhaps that helps us understand what Scripture is. Can Scripture be still inspired if it goes through this kind of a process? And I think that's a question that the Bible is answering with a resounding yes.
Yeah, nice.
And I like that. I really like that. And so I like what David brought in about how the text is structured in such a way that you still have inspiration, but you have humanity in there as well. And so it's this this uneasy, sometimes uneasy relationship between divinity and humanity that shines through the Bible. And we still have that to this very day. We can see it in our own LDS history, this divine and human element coming through. And
Joseph was pretty open about it in his own, you know, revelation and his own attempt to study more and, you know, and bringing in, you know, Satius and, you know, his studying of Hebrew and things like this. He was getting there, you know, during his own lifetime and kind of owning up to this whole thing, you know, and he does the JST, you know, right after the Book of Mormon and then, you know, later revelations and the DNC and stuff sort of don't match up exactly, you know, and the lectures on faith and all that stuff. So I think what you just said, it shouldn't scare us LDS folks to kind of see that you're constantly got to be doing the dynamic, the back and forth.
Absolutely. That's the way I look at it.
As Dr. Hansen has said, there is unity and diversity in the biblical narrative. And as James Sanders has said, it's the tension that causes us to grow.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, that's right.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thank you guys. I've loved it. Listeners, there's a one piece of the Bible, of the flood story that we didn't get to, and we're aware of that, and we're going to deal with that. I'm not sure if we'll get all the way to Abraham next time. We may just get through what I'm about to share with through Babel and whatnot before we go into the Abrahamic story and end up with the sacrifice of Isaac and all that stuff. But the piece is, of course, the cursing of Canaan that comes after Noah and the family have landed on the earth, and you know the vineyards are grown up, and Noah's drunk, and then you know he seems to be uncovered, and his son Ham has a son named Canaan. Ham, you know, there's just a lot of things that happen with that deal with race and the curses and things like that that come up with that, and we just didn't feel like we had enough time to do that in this podcast.
Yeah, that take us right into the Table of Nations of Genesis 10.
Yes, so we'll start there next time, and we're not sure how we'll go, but we are going to revisit this again probably in about 5 or 6 weeks. I don't want to overdose everybody, but we'll definitely get to some of the key sections before they come up in the Sunday school cycle that begins in January. So so by the time you hit those things in your classes, maybe this can be some resources for you, along with, of course, what Jared Anderson will be doing over at the Engaging Gospel Doctrine podcast that he does. So we'll hopefully dovetail a little bit between those two. So thanks again, everybody. I will provide links. It is the end of the year, and if Mormon Matters is something that's important to you, I'd love to be included in your year-end giving. And it is a tax-deductible donation, and any support would be wonderfully appreciated, as always. But even if it can't be financial, I hope that you'll continue to come, go to the website, the blog, make your comments known, write to me personally. Whatever it is that you want to engage, please keep doing that. You're the lifeblood of the podcast. So many of these shows come out of your ideas and my conversations with you. So again, just thank you for all the wonderful ways that you do support Mormon Matters. We want to keep it going, and I think we can, but the financial piece is awfully nice if it ever happens. So thank you very much. Guys, is it time just to say good day?
Absolutely, and it's wonderful to serve with such distinguished and wonderful colleagues.
Thanks, Brian, for being here as well.
Thank you, and it was a pleasure being with you today.
Well, Brian, it's a real joy to have you here as a colleague and fellow sojourner, and it's really the joy of my spiritual life right now doing these podcasts with such distinguished colleagues.
Well, thank you, Father Tom. I very much appreciate that. It's been a pleasure to be with you, too. You're a gentleman and a scholar.
Well, it takes one to know one.
All right, I like it. And we'll thank David again, who had to leave, as everyone knows, about 20, 30 minutes ago. So thank you, thank you, thank you. We wish you guys a good day, and we'll see you back for the next podcast. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.